Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Joe Zimmel and Valerie Friedman.
Faith here with your podcast, Welcome Toast. It was Mitch Hedberg who said, I like buying snacks from a vending machine because food is better when it falls. Sometimes at a grocery store, I'll drop a candy bar on the floor so it achieves its maximum flavor. Listen to our show in small bites or enjoy the whole thing.
I got that sunshine in my pocket, got that good soul in my feet. I feel that hot blood in my body when it drops.
It's great to have you joining the party on the Faith Middleton Food Schmooze, inviting you to eat, drink, and be merry with us. What a show we have planned for you. The best tips to know about cooking and eating corn on the cob. A funny play about a chef is at Theater Works in Hartford, The Raging Skillet. We'll meet the real chef on the show today, Rossi. It's her story. And it's National Rum Day, people. We're going to whip up a cocktail, you bet we are. We're here to assist you in having a good time and to celebrate the people, places, and food makers that we discover so you can too. My treasured food buddies are here. Senior contributors Chris Brassberry, Alex Province, Mark Raymond, senior producer Robin Doyen Aiken, and special guest Bailey Pryor. Hey, everybody.
Hello. How are you?
Okay. Bailey is representing Real McCoy Spirits, and they make some amazing rum. And so we're excited to have you back on the show.
Thanks, Faith. It's great to be here.
And it is National Rum Day, yes. So this is perfect. You know that I love tiki culture.
Yes, you're a tiki fan. I know that.
I've been one for 42 years. I will drive anywhere. 150 miles, if you tell me there's
the
a tremendous tiki cocktail maker somewhere. So I'm serious about it, and it just lights up my life. I think it's so much fun, the tiki stuff.
She has a tiki bar at her house.
Yes,
nice.
Doesn't have to drive far.
Tiki is so much fun. I mean, it's such a great culture in America, and you know, it's a truly American thing. It started in the 1930s, and today it's actually huge. There's a giant festival happening in San Diego next week called Tiki Oasis. It's basically Comic-Con for tiki fans. So thousands of people show up all dressed up in crazy tiki costumes and cocktails.
I'm just so upset that I'm not there this time.
Yeah. It is cool.
We have a cocktail posted on our website, and it's the one we're sipping right now. It is made with your Real McCoy rum.
Yes, our three-year rum.
Okay, and you created this cocktail in honor of National Rum Day on August 16th.
Yes, but also in honor of you. So we named it. We named the cocktail Faith in Tiki. That's the name of the cocktail.
Oh, I am so honored.
Faith in Tiki.
This is so delicious.
This is going to sound self-serving now because it is one of the great cocktails I have had in a decade. Thank you so much for the honor of the name,
sure. But
also the craft of making this cocktail. It's extraordinary. The recipe's on our website, foodschmooze.org. People, this one you have to make, I swear it has nothing to do with the name.
We got to get bars to make it.
If you're a rum fan, there are all kinds of rums, and they come from all kinds of places. The Real McCoy rum really is, and not because Bailey is here. We asked Bailey here because we're a fan of the rum that they make in Connecticut.
Thank you.
It is handcrafted. Mm-hmm. There is no junk in it. Well, what does your rum maker say, your spirit maker?
Well, our tradition with this rum is that we wanted to honor the history of Bill McCoy, who was the first rum runner of the Prohibition era. And he's the reason why we all know the term the Real McCoy. He was the first one to fill up a boat full of rum down in the Caribbean in January of 1920. Mm-hmm. He sailed it up to New York City, Montauk, Block Island, Fisher's Island, places like that, and sold it 3 miles offshore. And he never, and that was not illegal, because in 1920, 3 miles out was international waters. Today it's 200 miles out because
of
McCoy, but back then he could do it totally legally.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
So what a great history to have attached to your rum. But your rum is so delicious, and you make various ones.
We do.
But would you tell us, because we were dazzled by this thing. Mm-hmm. What is in here?
Well, the core ingredients are our three-year rum. So it's aged 3 years in American oak bourbon barrels, the Real McCoy three-year. And then we also put Velvet Falernum in there. And Velvet Falernum is also a product that's made on the base of our three-year rum. And so our master distiller, Richard Seal, uses a proprietary blend of spices and sweeteners, and he makes this lovely liqueur. It's about 11% alcohol, and it's called Velvet Falernum. It's very well known within the bartender community. It's often used as a very secret little ingredient in a lot of cocktails, but you can buy it at liquor stores, too.
And what does it do for a cocktail?
It adds a nice sweetness to the cocktail and also some Bajan spice, so some Barbados spicing. So you have some really nice sort of cinnamon allspice and things like that.
So that's where I'm getting that little nutmeggy, allspicy thing.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
What else is in here besides your rum, your Falernum?
The next thing we put in there is we're big fans of the ripe juice that's made here in Connecticut. They make a blend of juices called the Bajan Punch.
Based on those
based on those spices and the tropical fruits that would be in a place like Barbados. And the reason why they call it Bajan Punch is because the word Bajan, B-A-J-A-N, is a nickname for people in Barbados who are on island time, who are cool and relaxed. You're Bajan, you know? So it's a very nice, like, relaxing kind of cocktail drink.
You're Bajan,
you know,
man.
You're a Bajan.
I want to be on island time.
Exactly. So just have one of these cocktails and you'll immediately be on island time.
I think we are on island time, as a matter of fact. And then, are there any bitters?
We do a tiki bitters in there as well. And tiki bitters are lots of fun because they're highly secret. There's great competition between different bitter makers. And in this case, we're using the Fee Brothers. And we sometimes use Fentimans as well, both make really
both
great.
Very good. And are we at the end of the ingredients?
No, we have one more. The final component is the garnish, which in this case are two of the original Luxardo cherries. So the beautiful Luxardo cherries, which are the best cherries in the world for cocktails.
Honestly, they are. They're expensive, so I'm not going to pretend about that. The last time I went to shop for them, the price was too dear for me. So I didn't do it because I'm not buying it wholesale the way people are. So I understand if you say, but if you are a cocktail lover and you want to invest in this, they also are tremendous in a gin and tonic or a vodka tonic with a little dash of the syrup in the jar of these Luxardo cherries. And they're made with such care. They're so crazy delicious. When a bar has these, I know they're serious about cocktail making.
And you can always tell they're the real ones because they're not that bright iridescent pink color that you see for the cheap cherries. These are very dark colored, so you can spot them across the bar.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for the honor of this cocktail and for being such a craftsman in making this.
Thank
really
you.
So appreciate it. Absolutely delicious. It is up right now, Faith in Tiki at foodschmooze.org. And we have pictures of all the bottles that Bailey just used, all the products to make all this, the various rums. Bailey, I want to come back to your rum stuff. We're going to keep going with our little tiki celebration here on the show. But everybody, are you finding this? I'm crazy about corn. I'm practically pacing up and down because the corn is late. Yeah. I live both in Connecticut and on the east end of Long Island. And in both places, the corn is late. Are you all finding that?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And are you just craving?
We're starting to get some now. And
nothing better than local fresh corn.
Young's Farm has some early stuff, and it is really good.
Oh,
so
okay.
Just wait. This year is a good year for corn.
Is it?
Yeah.
Worth the wait.
What
it's
does that
so
mean to
sweet.
You? Sweet. Oh, that's
it
what I'm waiting
so for. So sweet. Oh, my God. 2 years a day right now.
Oh, yeah.
It's like a habit.
Oh, yeah.
And
your
I take,
medicine.
You know, and one of my guys taught me this. He just puts it in the oven with a little bit of salt. He takes it out of the husk, puts it on a little cookie sheet, a little bit of salt on, and that's it, and he roasts it.
No butter?
No butter, nothing. You put butter afterwards. But just in the oven like that, and it gets nice and charred after about 15 minutes, and then you just eat it right off the cob.
So I want to give you a couple of tips. We did some other tips from them, Cooks Illustrated, before. They did a little section on corn I thought was so good. They did a page called Fact or Myth, so we could play this game.
Yes.
But we told you last time about the easiest way to shuck.
I love that.
Now, this is something that I have believed my whole corn cooking life. When corn in a frozen bag from the supermarket has no flavor, I think, and so I put it in milk. And I think it sugars up the corn a little bit, and it tastes kind of real.
So saucepan and milk.
Yeah. And so some people will even cook their fresh corn out of the garden with a little milk in the boiling water.
Interesting.
Yeah. So they did fact and myth, and they said, that's a myth.
Mm-hmm. So,
not enough sugar.
They
I'm
did
trying
all
it
these taste tests and said, no, no, no. It doesn't do a darn thing. So I swear that it does in frozen corn because I think the milk sugars it. Mm-hmm. But they say no, at least with fresh corn, it doesn't do anything. Mm-hmm. So there you go. I was a little sad to find that out. Go ahead, Chris.
I have one. This is something I do every year, and I always say in the middle of the winter I didn't do enough. Whenever I get corn, I take 6 ears, put them aside, and after I'm done eating corn, I strip the kernels off and I make my own frozen corn, and then I have it all winter long, and then you never have that problem of that frozen corn not tasting good because the frozen corn you have in your freezer is the stuff that you had that summer.
Yeah.
And if you do it in the middle of February and you're having like a corn soup made with that corn, it brings you right back to summer.
I'm still a huge believer. I see everyone at the grocery store like pulling the husks off corn. I think you're supposed to take the corn with the husk, you soak it in some water, or if you're at the beach, in the salt water, and you roast it with the husk on, and then the husk gets all charred and blackened, and then you peel it back, and you have this beautifully steamed corn underneath.
People all have their own different way of doing it. Some people strip it. Some people do what you do, Alex, and gives it that nice smoky kind of feeling and steams it, and so it's kind of gently charred.
No wrong way. Just eat corn. Yeah. This time of year, just eat fresh corn.
So Matt was saying he was cutting the corn off the cob without cooking, and it's the corn that we've had so far has been so sweet, we're eating it even without cooking it.
You don't have to. You can just eat it raw like that. It's so good.
So I have a friend that actually takes that husk, he peels it back a little bit, butters up the corn, puts the husk, puts a little cilantro in there, and then puts the husk back on and then throws it on the grill. And then you actually get like
bacon.
You buttered get these already. Little charred spots.
Mark, who is that?
My friend Dave Werzer, and he does it down at his lake cottage in Oman.
Dave. Now, if I recall, Dave is the one who pulled out quite a snazzy bottle of wine
for
your hamburger.
Yes, he is. He's a fancy
guy. I think we need
guy.
To have Dave on the show.
With a bottle of wine.
And we'll provide the burgers, and Dave will provide the wine. Okay.
There we go.
So here's the thing that I wanted to tell you about that Cook's Illustrated said. If you want to make a beautiful corn soup, the way to do this is I throw my corn cobs away. What am I going to do with them? And especially if you have dogs around, you don't want them. Alex, you gave us that tip last time. It can kill a dog, so don't let them anywhere near that. But I throw them out. They said, no. They said, put those cobs into some boiling water. Uh-huh. Cut the cobs into quarters, put them in a saucepan with a couple quarts of water, simmer them, and cook them for about 15 minutes, then strain it. That liquid is the base, the stock. You've got corn stock, and when you add, if you do cream or you just do the corn itself,
or corn starch,
or you want to put clams in to make a clam corn chowder. Oh, my goodness, the difference in taste. This is what 4- and 5-star restaurants do.
Oh, my God. We do exactly that. And then right before we put it on the stove, we take our Parmesan rinds that we've been saving, and we throw that in, too. So we make a Parmesan corn stock and then make a corn soup out of that. And my God.
At the restaurant?
Because it gives a little salt. Because we use so much corn. We're making that corn stock every single day now.
Can I say one more? Now you've reminded me. One more thing. If you are cutting the kernels off the cob, whether they're cooked or uncooked, I don't do this. I cut just the tips off so that it stands up straight. And then you've got this long cob, and I'm being careful with my fingers. They said, don't do that. Cut the cob in half and then use the shorter thing. They won't fly all over the place.
Yep.
And it's
lay
just
it down on the cutting board and cut it and turn it as
That's
you cut
so
it.
Good.
It's the easiest way
Isn't
to
that
do
good?
It.
So why haven't I been doing that?
I know.
It makes sense. Yeah, you don't think about it because you automatically grab it by the top or the bottom and go down instead of laying it down, cutting it into smaller pieces, and going around it.
Chris, I thought of you the other day. Big Y had the old-fashioned 1970s.
We had corn holders.
Remember
this?
$2.98.
When we were kids, we each had our own little shaper thing of that. Oh, yeah.
The prongs.
Yeah, the little
prongs.
Yeah,
with
some of them were
the cornier.
Some of them were cornier. Some of them were little cars. We each had our own.
Little lobsters.
Yeah, little lobsters. Yeah, right?
I have little corn cob-shaped plates, little plastic corn plates. Nuts. Yeah.
Oh, that's cute.
I use them for banana splits too. They work.
Yeah. at my house growing up, you knew it was summer because my mom always had the butter dish, and it had like the corn divot.
Oh,
it had,
yeah.
It had the corn divot in
with
it.
With some of the silk
still in it. Silk in it. And that was always left out on the counter. You knew it was summer because you open up the lid to maybe put some butter on your bread, and it's like it had the corn silks on it and a divot in the middle of it.
I know. You see a lot more restaurants doing the Mexican street corn.
Oh, that's
Do you
good.
See that on the
yeah.
menu?
Oh,
I
yeah.
was
love that.
I was just at Noah's, not the one in Stonington, Connecticut, but the one in Greenport, New York, on the east end of Long Island, and they had, as an appetizer, they had Mexican street corn on the menu. They cut it up in quarters
beautiful.
And give you a beautiful array of it with a queso fresco cheese on it a little bit of spice, and it was really delicious. I had a great meal at Noah's in Greenport. So you can make your own chili lime salt if you want to do something fancy. You can flavor your butter for your corn, or you can do it the classic way. Just a little butter, maybe a little salt, and you're good to go.
Sometimes it's simple is the best.
Does anybody have a theory about why, when I was at Noah's, I had a steak, a delicious hanger steak. Does anybody have a theory about why corn goes so well with steak? Why is that?
Sweet and savory, right?
It's like steak and potatoes, I guess. Is
mashed
it because it's a
corn.
Starch?
Mashed potatoes and corn.
It's got to be
peas
the starch connection.
Peas
and
corn. Oh, I just
a bite of mashed potato with a few kernels of corn in it.
I don't know. Corn
I would
anything.
Always take my mashed potatoes and corn and just
mix
them
together.
Yeah.
And pour so you get
gravy.
Little bits.
Absolutely. That way you get a little
Can
bit
you
off.
Really taste the corn that way?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And that's how you butter your corn, because your mashed potatoes are butter. Is that is it
true? There's a lot of butter in my mashed potatoes. Yeah. That's
so I promise you, we're coming back to National Rum Day, which is August 16th, in our next segment. And later on in the show, we have someone who has done the best food memoir. Honestly, it is so fantastic, and it's been made into a play that is at Theater Works in Hartford. It's called Raging Skillet, the name of the memoir and the play. So we're going to tell you all about that. We're going to meet the person, Rossi, she has one name. We're going to meet the person on whom this story is based. It's really a funny book. Really interesting about how somebody gets started in the food world, especially a woman who's kind of out there. She's really fantastic. I can't wait to meet her. Okay, but National Rum Day continues, and we have a wine to tell you about. More mouthwatering conversation and fun ahead on the Faith Middleton Food Schmooze. We're glad you have a seat at the table. I hope you will make a charitable contribution to Feed the Hungry. We're online now at foodschmooze.org, and we'll be right back.
Will his love be like his rum? Yes, it will. Yes, it will. Intoxicating all life long. Yes, it will. Yes, it will.
Everybody.
Drink this toast. Drink this wedding toast.
Beans and cornbread. Beans and cornbread. Beans and cornbread.
Beans and cornbread had a fight.
Beans
knocked cornbread out of sight.
Beans.
Cornbread said, now that's all right.
Beans.
Meet me on the corner tomorrow night.
I'll be ready. I'll be ready tomorrow night.
Oh, boy. Listen, sign up for our free podcast, and you can listen on your schedule. That's the value of a podcast. You just go to our website, foodschmooze.org. You sign up just once, and it arrives to you. It's how all of us listen.
Mm-hmm.
I am with my treasured food buddies, Chris Prosperi. You can tell I'm in love, right? Everybody can tell. Chris Prosperi, chef and co-owner of Metro Beast Restaurant in Simsbury, Connecticut. Wine broker Alex Province in Hartford. Mark Raymond, our wine broker in Wethersfield. Robin Doyen Aiken is the senior producer. And we have a special guest, Bailey Pryor from Real McCoy Rum, right here in Connecticut. And he's the co-founder of this company. Beautiful, beautiful rum that they make. And we have
Thank
him here. He's back again because it is National Rum Day. on August 16th. Robin told us that, and we said, oh.
Thanks, Robin.
That is a very serious responsibility.
Got to keep your food holidays straight.
I want to also thank Bailey again for creating this cocktail that I'm sipping that is called Faith in Tiki, and it is wildly delicious. I have nothing to do with it except to be honored by having the name. Bailey and his team created this recipe, and it is one of the best cocktails I think I've ever had.
Thank you.
It's at foodschmooze.org.
What, four, Chris? Or maybe five yummies.
What's that, oh, a
yeah.
scale?
Yeah, five, definitely five.
Five,
that would
top. A yummy five scale?
Yeah, I have a yummy scale.
That would definitely that would clean house yummy. At the martini contest.
That would totally, that would at our past martini contest, that would be a top winner.
Now, I'm going to do one thing before the rum starts, because I thought, where in the heck did rum come from? What do we need to know to appreciate good rum? Should we use good rum in a cocktail? Does it really make a difference? And
absolutely.
I'm not talking about what's in the interest
really
of the maker. No. Sorry, Bailey.
No, it's true.
You know, it would be really fun to get into some of this stuff. And don't forget, at the end of the show, we have an extraordinary woman who is so funny, and so is her memoir, The Raging Skillet. And there's a play about it at Theater Works in Hartford, and it's a hit. If you know what it's like to grow up in an Orthodox Jewish home at the dawning of the microwave, and oh my goodness, it is really quite a story. We're going to jump quickly into a wine because we always like to have one on the show. This is from San Mateo, the maker, and it is called Gavi. It is from a protected region of Italy, meaning it uses a Cortese grape, but it also means it has to be made in a traditional way. It's from one of my favorite places in Italy, the Piemonte region, which is still the real Italy.
So Gavis are fun because they're inexpensive. So this is one of those wines that you would have on a weeknight. It's $12. You would have it with some antipasti. You might have it with like some grilled fish.
Nothing. You might have it with nothing.
Might have just it as an aperitif.
Mark Raymond, also our wine guy.
Gavi, to me, has always been one of those refreshing, crisp wines that you have with two dishes I always think to pair with this. Linguine white clam sauce
and
shrimp piccata. Whenever I'm having those two dishes, I always look to serve it with Gavi.
And can I say that this is a great wine to go with pesto?
Oh, yeah.
Pesto turns out to be a pretty difficult thing to match up with in terms of wine, in the way that asparagus also can be, or artichoke. It's a little tricky, and you're always wanting a dry white wine. This is a wine that I would just so enjoy with pesto. If you're someone who's got the basil pumping up in the garden and you want to have a good pesto.
Perfect time of year for that.
Yeah.
If you're a Pinot Grigio drinker but want something that's well-made, comes from a smaller appellation.
A little more floral special character to it, I think, than Pinot
minerality.
Grigio.
Yeah, yep. I mean, so if you like that kind of crisp style wine, this would be like a no-brainer.
So this growing region gets really slammed with all these little microclimates. The weather's constantly changing because of them. That can do interesting things to wine.
Yeah, you can get a lot of variety from a small territory, right? Lots of different flavor profiles are coming out of very, very neighboring
vineyards. Exactly. That's
for
why
sure.
wine is exciting. Then it's a recipe.
These grape growers have learned from their parents and grandparents and great-grandparents, and this is what they're like genetically made to do, is make wine.
And so this wine is around, what did we say, $12?
$12.
So this is a good weeknight price for people. We like it for that. This is a wine that's made in a real way. Mm. Bailey, you know about all the crazy thousands of additives that can be in a wine.
Absolutely.
Place like this,
absolutely.
This is real wine.
Especially in the large volume wines, there are quite a bit of additives that can be put in there. People use clarifying agents, they use sweeteners, they use propylene glycol, which gives a mouthfeel to it. It's very, very interesting what some of the bigger brands end up doing. And when you can find a nice wine like this, it's quite dry. I thought it was very enjoyable, but you also got a sense of sort of the location. I mean, to me, it just tasted like a warm day, you know, in Italy. It was wonderful.
Here's another thing. If you're someone who likes to do this, and I do any time of year, take a baguette, brush some olive oil, maybe rub a little garlic on it, slap on a particularly beautiful cheese, and run it under the broiler or in the grill for just a couple of minutes. With this wine, that would be fantastic.
And I'm thinking fresh tomatoes, some mozzarella, a little olive oil,
a little
balsamic,
basil,
some fresh basil, some salt.
Yeah. Okay. way. So outside, $12.
All we need now is opera.
Yeah.
Food schmooze. Foodschmooze.org. We have a picture of the label. We tell you the price and what to say at your wine store. It's San Mateo. That's the name of the vineyard. They're Gavi. It's 100% Cortese grapes, high minerality, very acidic, delicious, dry white wine, and really a bargain. Okay.
Absolutely.
All right. Thanks, guys. Back to Bailey Pryor as we celebrate National Rum Day, everybody. I'm taking a sip of the Faith and Tiki cocktail that they just made for us here on the Food Schmooze, and it's on the website, foodschmooze.org. Bailey, how did rum come to be?
Well, rum has an amazing history, and it goes back about 5,000 years, actually. When the still was originally invented in the Middle East, it was used to create essences. So they were making perfumes. And so there was a lot of natural existing sugarcane in East Asia, and the still kind of made its way across to East Asia. And that's the first known time, about 4,000 to 5,000 years ago, is when people were distilling cane spirit. And it became very popular.
Did you say they were making perfume?
Perfumes in the Middle East, that's what the device was created for. It's kind of ironic.
The device, I see.
Because they didn't drink,
people who
right?
don't drink alcohol invented the device that makes distilled alcohol. And so that was utilized by other traders who bought them and brought them over to their territory, and they made rum.
And who were the people at the time who said, hey, this is pretty good?
Well, I guess it would be all sorts of venturers and travelers, because ultimately the sugarcane stalks themselves and the still ended up into Europe. And so when you get to about the era of Christopher Columbus, one of the key possessions that he brought with him to the Caribbean on his first trip there to find the lost city of El Dorado. His goal was to find the city of gold in the Americas. And when he went across and discovered the island of Hispaniola, he brought sugarcane with him. And now it had never existed in the Caribbean before that. We go down there now and you see sugarcane everywhere down there.
Yeah.
And you think that it was never there naturally. It was all
and
brought
Florida.
Over by the Europeans in Florida. So that was a transplant. And what ended up happening, it's kind of ironic that Columbus was trying to find the lost city of gold, but, and he ended up sort of like abducting people and trying to get them to tell him where the city of gold was, and there wasn't one. So he eventually gave up and went back to Spain, and he had told the Queen of Spain that he was going to find the city of gold. That's why she gave him the money to do the expedition, which basically found the Western world. But within 70 years, the price of refined sugar per ounce became more valuable than the price of gold. So the ironic thing there was Columbus actually brought the gold with him. He just didn't know it. And that's why the monarchs of Europe took all the islands in the Caribbean, the French islands, the British islands, the Spanish, the Dutch islands, all were grabbed by those monarchs because they could basically print money. And that's why the slave trade became big there, because they were growing sugar. That was really the economic origin of this.
And we still see this today, the geopolitics, the fights that are going on right this minute over which countries have which minerals, and whether China is going to cozy up to that country the most, or the United States is.
Sure.
The minerals we need to do very important things.
Well, yeah, it's all about resources. The planet Earth is a spaceship with about 800 million seats, and we have about 7 billion people on the planet. And so you got to think about where are they all going to be utilized. That's a big topic in politics for sure. But in rum, it's actually kind of interesting, because many of the islands now aren't even producing fruit anymore, including sugarcane. Lots of them have stopped doing it because sort of the bottom fell out from that economically, that market, in the late 1800s, and then it came back again and then bottomed out again. So some of the islands utilize a lot of sugarcane, and the ones that do then farm out molasses. They sell molasses to the other islands, and people make rum there. In our case, we grow it right on the farm in Barbados.
Oh, you do?
We do, yeah.
You have your own farm, or you hire?
Yeah.
Oh, I see.
Foursquare Distillery, Richard Seals on Barbados. He's our master distiller, so he grows the sugarcane on the property, and then sometimes when he doesn't have a high enough yield, he'll buy some Demerara molasses that he gets from Guyana. A special type of molasses.
Huh. Is it organic?
It's not organic. There's no consistent soil on these islands. It's not like they have really great. Yeah, well, it's coral. So
are there chemicals in the growing of sugarcane that should concern us?
Not necessarily, no. I think you have traditional.
How about your sugarcane?
We don't have anything that's going to be an issue, like pesticides and things like that.
That's
it's more like nitrogen-based fertilizers.
Oh, no, I meant.
But pesticides, no, it's very expensive to do that. Anything you're doing on an island, just move the decimal point over to get any resource or equipment or you know, technology or technique there, it's very difficult.
So Bailey Pryor of Real McCoy, I had a sense years ago when I was tasting rum that it seemed very syrupy to me, over-sugared.
Most rums are sweetened. Yeah. So it's kind of interesting. Rum was always a drier spirit, and people didn't start adding large amounts of sugar to it and other types of sweeteners until after about the 1940s. And there was a gentleman named Rafael Arroyo, who's sort of the grandfather of the modern form of distillation. He was really opposed to the development and use of multi-column stills. He thought that the best type of product, whether it was whiskey or rum, was being made in a pot still. Mm-hmm. And I completely agree with him, because you just get incredible flavors from pot stills that you just cannot get from a column still. And so when people started doing large volume multi-column still products, you end up with a very highly refined product. It's very
stripped. Like medicinal,
it's,
right?
Yeah, it's basically grain alcohol.
Neutral.
You've made sugarcane vodka. It has really no flavor, no aroma, no components to it that are interesting.
So
they added sugar, they added flavors. Some rums even add artificial rum flavoring to it, like the cheapest rums. So the ones in the plastic bottle on the bottom of the shelf, you might want to think about that next time you pick up one of those.
Yeah.
So Matt and I actually got scared, because we love drinking rum, and we researched some of the big brands, and they're loaded with like sugar and all the stuff that we didn't want to drink anymore.
Yeah, and propylene glycol. That's the big one, because propylene glycol is antifreeze.
Isn't that a rocket fuel?
It's antifreeze. It's the stuff they spray on the wings of airplanes when you're about to take off in a snowstorm.
Yeah,
you can even smell the sweetness of it. When you're sitting in the plane, there's kind of an interesting sweet smell from that stuff.
Yeah.
They put that in all kinds of spirits, especially vodka, but they do put it in the cheaper rums.
Really?
And the reason why they do it is because it's a sweetener, but it has a thick mouth feel to it. So people go, this is so smooth because it's sweet.
Yeah. How do you know which vodka doesn't have it?
You have to do your research.
Yeah.
And there are websites now that you can do this
online,
because
we just Google it and then
can someone just tell me
Drecon.dk, DRECON.dk is the one that tells you how much sugar there are. There's many websites that do this, by the way, but the European Union, it's illegal to use propylene glycol in any products in the European Union. That's not the case in the United States, so it's in everything here.
How about in the Scandinavian countries?
Scandinavian can't use it there as well. And so this is the Danish, it's a Danish gentleman who's done this program for the government to study all of these products. So he tests and he can tell how much sugar people are adding to their rum. So he has this whole list of how much sugar. And there are some rums out there that have 96 grams of sugar per liter, which is, think of it this way, it's
like
a
soda.
Cup of sugar that you pour
into
one
bottle.
It takes up about a third of the bottle. It's insane, right? And you know it immediately. The minute you sip those, it just tastes like...
You wonder why you get a headache.
My rum, we don't do that, by the way. Let me just say that.
No, I know. Yes.
That's why we like love it.
That's why I'm talking about it. The other guys don't even talk about this.
I know. So use a good quality rum.
You got to use a good quality rum. You've got to have
for
something.
For a cocktail?
For a cocktail,
even though you've
absolutely,
got all this
because
other
then you don't have all
there.
That junk in there. Yeah. Absolutely.
But I may not have all that junk, but I can't taste the rum exactly because I've got all these other competing flavors.
Exactly. And if you have a real rum that's just been barrel aged, like the Real McCoy, you end up with really nice natural flavor components, and it cuts right through whatever mixer you're using. So if you're using fruit juice or you're using sodas or ginger beer, you can still taste the spirit, and it's lovely and balanced. And that's why you like that cocktail so
and
much.
And you need less like mixers and stuff too, with good ingredients. You don't need to mask it with
exactly.
stuff.
Yeah, I wanted you to defend your position. It's like, you did a fabulous job.
Thank you.
Really, thanks for making a great product.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Bailey Pryor of Real McCoy Rum, right here in... I shouldn't say made here because the sugar cane is grown in Barbados.
We live here. It's owned in Mystic, Connecticut.
Yes, in Mystic, Connecticut.
Too.
Yep.
Thank you.
And they have various aging steps depending on the bottle that you get. Our cocktail they made, the Faith in Tiki, is at foodschmooze.org, one of the best cocktails I have had ever. We love the local. We've got somebody really funny coming your way next. Please support your local food growers and food makers for an on-demand podcast delivery of the Food Schmooze Party every week. Go to foodschmooze.org, and you know, we'll be right back.
Mix it with rum. Mix it with rum.
Ooh, I'm a rebel just for kicks now. I've been feeling it since 1966 now.
The This is the Food Schmooze Party, offering the richness of life and coming to you in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including Westchester County, the East End of Long Island, the Hamptons, of course. The senior producer is Robin Doyon Aiken. And to hear the show on WNPR, it airs Thursdays at 3, at 9, and Saturdays at noon. Podcasts and our curated recommendations are always online at foodschmooze.org. Okay. You're in for a good time reading this hilarious book, The Raging Skillet, and seeing the play about it, having its world premiere now at Theater Works in Hartford. It's on through August 27th. The woman at the center of the memoir, this play, is Rossi, no first name, owner and executive chef of The Raging Skillet. That's a catering company in New York City. They do not do typical events. They do events on the wild side, like one in an old synagogue that's turned into a goth party space on the Lower East Side, or in a factory in Queens. All I know is that I loved her memoir about becoming a chef, starting out in a Jewish Orthodox home. Her childhood recipes are sensational. And as you're about to hear, so are her adult recipes. Nice. And as you're about to hear, Rossi, welcome to the Food Schmooze Party.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here.
Oh, my goodness. So what does it feel like to stand back and see your life, your memoir, come to life on a stage? What's that experience like, seriously?
It's a very surreal experience. Ever since it opened, people have been asking me, how do you feel? How do you feel? And I've been having an enormous problem answering that question.
Mm-hmm.
Because how I feel is so huge and beyond me that I can't even get to the core of it. I think I need a year and some therapy to go back and look back and tell you how I feel.
You're lucky I have a fake therapy degree. So
maybe we could spend a couple of hours talking after the show.
Okay.
But I mean, it's so surreal. I'm looking up on the stage and I see a woman playing my mother and a woman playing me, and they're flashing images of my mom and my grandparents. And so I would have to say, in the 70s, late 70s and early 80s, I experimented with drugs, but I never, ever got to try anything that feels this intense and wonderful. So if there was something
cool
like this, I would think it would be very popular.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Great description.
We try to make the show be like that, as a matter of fact. So here's my question about this struggle that people have about the difference between what's real and unreal, the difference between fiction and nonfiction. Some of us think that fiction is real, that it is coming from a place in people, while details are made up, represent the human experience. And other people feel you've got to stick to facts. We've seen authors get in trouble for this because they get confused about it, or maybe they have a different idea. I don't care whether it's exactly strictly according to your life, because it's almost like an author letting go of the story, right? Right,
right,
Rossi?
Right.
So have you had to do that a little bit, let go?
Well, I'll tell you the truth. There's a lot of reasons why I wrote the book. But mostly it was because you just can't make this stuff up. I mean, I've had a really, truly crazy life, and my mother was insane. I could write 100 books about my mother. And so there really never came a moment when I had to embellish or think of something cool to say. It was very much the opposite. There are so many crazy things that happened in my house. I never run out of stories.
Yeah.
I'm always waiting for the moment that I'll run out of material.
So I
have written fiction, but it's not nearly as good.
Yeah. So explain just quickly where you grew up in the very beginning, where your story starts.
Well, I grew up on the Jersey Shore, and I grew up a very odd combination of, let's say, lowly Orthodox Jewish and white trash. So I'm probably the only person you're going to meet that can honestly say I have eaten kishka and grits. So sort of sum it up like that.
So it's an Orthodox household, and your mother, as you describe in your memoir, discovers the microwave and everything goes to hell.
Right.
I mean, everything that was real, that simmered for hours, is
right
out the window. And you start sprinkling in recipes in your memoir based on where you are in your life. And these recipes get to be very, very good. In the beginning, they might be good, but they're kind of kid friendly. So I'm looking at this one that says Snickers and potato chip casserole.
Here's the thing about that. That's a recipe I created when I was 13 years old. Mm-hmm. So you would think that that's a horrible recipe, or how good could a recipe be that a 13-year-old with no experience cooking created it? But I've been serving that at weddings I cater. I mean, when I started recipe testing, when I did the book, I had to recipe test it. So I kind of tweaked the recipe a little bit. You don't cook the butter on high, you cook it on low, this kind of thing. But I've been serving it, and people are going nuts for it.
Awesome.
And in the play, they pass it out to the audience, and the audience goes nuts
for it.
That's
awesome.
So those recipes aren't really so bad.
Can I say it's a couple Snickers bars, some sweet butter, marshmallows, and potato chips. And it's, it's the way it comes together. So from your mother at the table, what do you think you took?
Well, my mom used to cook these Ashkenazi Hungarian dishes passed down from the Ice Age. I mean, every time we came home, there'd be onions simmering and stews and things. And I honestly have had relationships that were shorter than some of these dishes took to cook. But we were like kids in the 70s. Like, we didn't want to come home and eat goulash and chicken paprika and Hungarian cabbage and noodles. We wanted pizza and spaghetti and meatballs and cheeseburgers and, normal American 70s food. And so we were kind of horrified. But when my mom got her first microwave, suddenly it was like all of that was gone and replaced with astronaut food. Like, she'd dump something in a bowl and mix water, and 2 seconds later, here's dinner. And so we realized that we had a good thing, and we spent so much time kvetching about it. We should have just been, like, kissing her tushy. And so everybody was so bored. And it's like, if your stomach is bored, your soul is bored. So, I saw that there were some frozen Lender's bagels in the freezer, and we had some leftover Passover cheese, and we always had ragu tomato sauce because my mother got it, like, 10 cans for a dollar or 10 jars for a dollar or something. So we had, like, hundreds of jars of ragu tomato sauce. And so I figured if I dumped the sauce on the bagels and covered it with the cheese, we only had 3 spices in the house ever. One was dry oregano, one was paprika, and one was gilt. So I figured, I'll sprinkle the oregano, hold the gilt and paprika, shoved it in the oven. And so comes dinner time, my mom's serving, this horrible microwave crap. And I pull these things out of the oven. And my family's astonished. They're kind of in shock because we forgot we even had an oven. And they're just blown away. It's not like it was such an exciting thing, but it was hot from the oven food once again.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, everyone in my family started being really nice to me.
Yeah.
I was like, whoa.
A chef is born.
Yeah, I'm like,
seriously.
Everyone's kissing my tushy. I really like this.
Yeah, so did that seriously... that newfound power send you in a direction of, I think I'll keep this up, and maybe I have some talent here, maybe I can do this?
Well, I didn't have any idea if I had any talent, and I had not a single thought about ever doing it professionally. But I did start having these parties for my little stoner friends in high school where I would serve my weird creations, and usually one of the ingredients would be Snickers bars.
Totally.
And I found it made me immensely popular. Most of the things I created in that era, you really had to smoke marijuana to appreciate, I have to admit. But
well,
not all of them.
I guess. So this is Chef Rossi, who's author of the paperback memoir, The Raging Skillet, and it is now a play at TheaterWorks in Hartford, and that runs through August 27th, so you want to jump on that. We have a link for tickets and information about the book, too, which I adored reading, at foodschmooze.org. The stage play is by Jacques Lamar and is directed by John Simpkins, and it is a world premiere at TheaterWorks, so congratulations to you. There's a hot plate, Hebrew Nationals, and pasta in here. On and on it goes. So there are so many details about your life. We can't get into all of them. There's a special friend that you make. But always, it seems to me, you were the one who was outside the box.
Always.
How did you get comfortable being there? Some people aren't comfortable being there.
Well, I figured out, because we moved around a lot as a kid, and everyone in my family, my sister and my brother, we all got bullied because we were always the new kids in the school, and we were always wearing this horrible clothes because my mother always got our clothes on sale, so everyone else had nice clothes, and we'd show up with these Kmart Blue Light specials. Do you remember Kmart Blue Light?
Yeah, oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah, people were always trying to bully us, and I figured out that I could defend myself with humor. So, you know, I would go to school, and here I am dressed so badly, but I would take my lunch out and put it on the table, and everyone else would have these beautiful sandwiches. My mother would send me with this deconstructed sandwich where it'd be like the cheese and the bread and the mustard, and you had to assemble it yourself. You know, kind of breed ingenuity with the kids. Like, no wonder I became a chef. So that was maybe embarrassing enough, but then everything would be wrapped in a note. So the mustard stolen from McDonald's would be like, have this mustard and know your mother loves you. And the bread would be wrapped in, this is more than I had as a child. And the cheese would be like, children in Auschwitz would have eaten this for a week, you know. So I'm pulling out these notes, and everyone's like, you made this up. You made those notes yourself. And they're going hysterical. And so nobody wanted to mess with me. They were too busy laughing.
Yeah. What would you say is the first serious relationship that you have?
That would be a love affair relationship?
Yeah, romantic.
I had dated guys a lot in high school because I was, you know, that's a thing to do. But I didn't realize that I was gay. I had no idea. But I had this great friendship with this woman who looked like a punk rock Audrey Hepburn. Right. She was so sexy. And one night we're out clubbing, and I said very innocently, with no, I mean, I'm so naive, you have to understand, I had no idea what this meant. I said, you know, I had this dream I kissed you. And she said, oh, really? And then we started making out, and I thought I was going to pass out. It suddenly woke up my universe. And then she left me in the bathroom. So, of course, the most important moments in my life have to happen in a bathroom. I don't know if that's a Jewish
thing. In the bar somewhere.
She left me there, and I'm like, I'm having my whole life flash by. I'm like, that's why I had to watch The Bionic Woman every Wednesday, and that's why I had to bring my teacher an apple. You
know? What's that? Who is that Prairie Woman doctor that people... okay, so amazing. And you end up cooking in Provincetown. You end up cooking on water. You cooked on water as a boat chef. And, you know, that's a whole experience.
It's ironic because I have a terrible problem getting seasick.
Yeah, me too. How in the world did you end up doing this truly professionally and as a professional now during your sort of outside-the-box catering company called The Raging Skillet also, by the way? Go ahead.
I was a bartender, one of those old-school kind of bartenders. We light your cigarette, you know, back when you could smoke in a bar. And we tell a joke, and we know everyone's name. So I always had regulars. I would have the same 30 or 40 regulars that would come every day, and I would keep them entertained. But they would stay, and the kitchen would close, and they'd be drinking, and there'd be no food. So I started going into the kitchen looking for things in the walk-in to turn into something they could eat so they wouldn't get drunk and throw up on my bar. There were always corn chips, and there was always some sort of cheese, and there was always a way to invent a nacho. So I started doing, like, the nachos of the night. And if there was buffalo chicken, I would cut it up and throw it on the nachos. Mm. If there was meatballs, you know, whatever it was. And they loved it, of course, because what would you love to eat when you're drunk at midnight? You'd love buffalo chicken nachos. But it started really jazzing me up. Like, I felt this kind of buzzing solar plexus feeling that I would get, like, when I wrote something or painted something, you know, a really good feeling. I thought, well, I'm kind of tired of talking to drunks all the time. Like, maybe I could do this instead.
And it really took off.
It did. I mean, it was really hard. In the 80s, it was so unwelcome to women. Mm. Nobody wanted to see a woman in the kitchen, which to this day I never understood. Like, you always want your mother's home cooking or your wife's home cooking, so why is it such an abomination for a woman to be in the kitchen? There were some pioneers that started breaking things down, like Alice Waters and, of course, Julia Child, but really it was nobody wanted me there. I would go to these big companies, and they didn't want to get sued, so instead of saying no or firing me, they would just do anything they could to make me quit. They would put me through terrible torture. You know, it made me madder and madder, and the madder I got, the less I was willing to quit. And eventually, you know, got past it and was able to start my own business, but it took a while.
Hmm. Do you think you'll stay?
People are always telling me that my business would be a lot larger if I would get out of the kitchen, because the best salesperson I have is me, and so we're constantly booking events. But when I'm in the kitchen cooking, you know, I'm not talking to people and we're not booking events. But if I remove myself from the kitchen completely, then that's the end of how I get my yayas. So I need to kind of keep my joy happening, too. So I sit in the corner, the table right by the window, like the Queen of England, and I make the sauces and marinades and dips, and everyone else is frying and dicing and sautéing and suffering. And I'm like, you know, having my little yayas up there.
Nice.
Right now, I'm still kind of got my fingers in the sauce, you know?
Yeah, I do. Well, you certainly can write like a dream. Yeah. I love the memoir. It's called The Raging Skillet, The True Life Story of Chef Rossi, a memoir with recipes. There are recipes from childhood to adulthood in this book, and really enjoyed them and your story. It's that winding road that many people take to get to a place. It's wonderful. It's funny as can be. So, and also a play about it now at Theater Works in Hartford, running through August 27th. And we have a link for tickets, information, and the book at foodschmooze.org. Thank you so much, Chef Rossi.
Oh, I had a blast.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
We're on WNPR Thursdays at 3 and Saturdays at noon. Weekdays, listen for my 60-second food schmoozes. Our slogan, never eat more than you can lift. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.
Everybody eats when they come to mind.
Thanks for listening to the podcast on your schedule. And when you need a little party in your life, we're here and online all the time at foodschmooze.org. And of course, also on Facebook at Faith Middleton Food Schmooze.